Chapter 16, verse 12. The sixth angel poured his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. We started talking about this verse last week, and when we ended last time, I had mentioned that there might be in that verse, in that description of the sixth bowl, a historical allusion to something from history that is being alluded to here. We've seen that a number of times in the book of Revelation, and we may be seeing that here. This bowl, as you'll recall, depicts a threat of invasion. And as we know in Revelation, Babylon, who of course was a past enemy of God's people, is used to depict Rome, which at the time of this writing, of this book, was a current enemy of God's people. And interestingly, history tells us that ancient Babylon was once defeated by a dried up river. Well, how did that happen? Last week, we mentioned that historical Babylon fell to the Persians without a shot ever being fired. Instead, as we discussed, there's some evidence that certain priests of the false god Marduk thought the then current rulers in Babylon were just a little too impious, and they would prefer the Persians. So they opened the gates and let the Persians into the city. Well, which gates were those that were opened? That's where the historical allusion comes in, because Herodotus picks up the story there. And he tells us that the Persians conquered Babylon by drying up the river Euphrates, the same river that's mentioned here in chapter 16 of Revelation. What they did is they diverted that river, which ran right through the center of Babylon. They diverted it into a dry lake bed so it became dry, and they could then go in to that part of Babylon through the dry riverbed. There was still one more problem, though. There were these giant gates that kept them from going from the dry riverbed into the city, and it's those gates that were left open by the priest and by the people who wanted them to come in and conquer Babylon, which is what they did. So there may be a historical allusion here that's coming to mind as John mentions here, the river Euphrates being dried up to prepare the way for the invaders. You know, our frequent comparisons between ancient Babylon and modern Rome, modern at the time John was writing, I think those comparisons are vital to our understanding of this book. Those who argue that the cataclysms in Revelation have to literally occur, they need to explain why those same cataclysms did not literally occur with ancient Babylon. An interesting exercise, if I were still making my living teaching, this is where I would say, here's homework for you, and that is to go and read Jeremiah 50 and 51. Read those two chapters, Jeremiah 50 and 51, and remember that Babylon fell without a shot being fired. And those two chapters are describing the fall of Babylon with much of the same language that we're seeing here in the description of Rome. Is there then some sort of a historical contradiction in the Bible that the Bible describes it as a cataclysm and in fact it fell without a shot being fired? Well, of course not. In fact, Isaiah prophesied exactly how literal Babylon, ancient Babylon, would fall. In Isaiah 45, verse 1. And he even gave the name of the conqueror before that conqueror was born. Isaiah named Cyrus before Cyrus was born. And listen to what Isaiah said about how Babylon would fall. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him. I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. That's Isaiah telling how Babylon would fall, the gates being opened, and naming the conqueror, Cyrus, before that conqueror was even born. So the Bible knew exactly how Babylon would actually fall, but it also described it in vivid apocalyptic terms, very similar to what we're studying here about Rome. From an earthly perspective, the fall of Babylon may not have looked like much, but not so from God's perspective. He saw it as the stars falling from heaven as he conquered Babylon as he had said he would long before the event. And we need to see things through God's eyes as he tells us how things really look. Who are the kings from the east in verse 12? Well, some say they're the allies of Rome who are pictured as rushing to her aid. But the text indicates that God dries up the river to help them get there. So does that mean they're on God's side? No, it only means that God is using them for his own purposes as he judges Rome. We see that many times through the Bible. In fact, verse 14 may show us these very same kings preparing for battle against God. We should likely view these kings here as we did the kings of the sixth trumpet. We talked about a number of weeks ago. That is, they likely depict the Parthians, whom the Romans feared would one day conquer them. Barclay explains it well. The greatest enemies of Rome, the one nation she could not subjugate, were the Parthians, who lived beyond the Euphrates. Their cavalry was the most dreaded force of fighting men in the world. For them to come sweeping across the Euphrates was a thought to strike terror in the bravest heart. Well, did Parthia literally conquer Rome? No. Was an attack from Parthia something that Rome feared and something that would strike terror and something that could be figuratively used to depict the fall of Rome? Absolutely, and that's how it's used here. None of the previous bowls literally occurred, and this bowl is no different. Their purpose is to paint a picture of complete and total destruction and terror, and that is what this bowl conveys. Verse 13. And I saw issuing from the mouth of the dragon and from the mouth of the beast and from the mouth of the false prophet three false spirits like frogs. For they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Lo, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is he who is awake, keeping his garments that he may not go naked and be seen exposed. The false prophet is mentioned here. He's also mentioned later in chapter 19 and chapter 20. If we compare the descriptions of this false prophet with the descriptions of the second beast from the earth that we saw in chapter 13, we're going to find they're identical. That second beast from the earth that represents the false religious side of Rome, that's the false prophet we see here and also in chapters 19 and 20. And the beast standing next to the false prophet, that's the beast from the sea that we saw in chapter 13. And standing behind, pulling the strings, that's Satan. That's the dragon. These three are assembled against the advancing armies of God. The dragon, Satan, the power behind Rome. The beast from the sea, the civil, military, persecuting side of Rome. And the false prophet, the beast from the earth, the false, perverted, religious side of Rome. All arrayed against God. They form a hideous contrast to the Godhead. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. That's the contrast we see here with these hideous three on earth arrayed against the forces of God. We've seen much come from the mouth of this dragon and his minions. In chapter 12, we saw a flood come from the mouth of the dragon. We saw blasphemies come from the mouth of the first beast in chapter 13. We saw deceit come from the mouth of the second beast in chapter 13. Here we see foul, demonic spirits like a frog emerge from the mouth of these three. These spirits perform signs and assemble the whole world for battle. Why are they compared to frogs? Well, frogs are famous for their empty and their continuous croaking. Even today we have an idiom, a frog in your throat. The sound of a frog is symbolic for meaningless speech. And such speech characterized what the dragon was saying and what these beasts were saying. There may even be a historical allusion here. One historical ancient writer of the day remarked that Nero was nearly reincarnated as a viper, but mercifully was allowed to come back as a frog so he could continue his singing. My guess is that was written after Nero had left. In verse 15, a voice, almost certainly Jesus, says that he is coming as a thief. What does that mean? Rome had no idea what was coming. Rome would have never have dreamed they were going to lose this fight. Rome thought it was the eternal kingdom. Rome had no idea that the church was the eternal kingdom. To Rome, this judgment was not only a mystery, this judgment was a surprise. It was a shock. They were not prepared for it. It would come totally unannounced to them. And that is something it has in common with the final judgment at the end of all time, which 1 Thessalonians 5:2 also tells us will come as a thief, totally unannounced. But this description does mark a difference with the description of the judgment of Jerusalem that we've often looked at in Matthew 24, for example, because that judgment did not come as a thief. That judgment came with signs. That judgment was announced. That judgment came with warnings. Not so here. Rome had no idea what was coming. Verse 16. And they assembled them at the place, which is called in Hebrew Armageddon. If chapter 13, verse 18, with its reference to 666, is the most well-known verse in Revelation, then this one probably comes in second place. If you ask the man on the street about Armageddon, you will most likely hear that it marks the location of the great battle at the end of the world. Before we even get into what Armageddon is, let me ask a question. Where did we get the idea that there will be a great battle, or any battle, at the end of the world? Where do we get that idea? That's the time when every knee will bow to Jesus Christ. That's the time when Jesus will come to claim His own. There will be no need for fighting. The fighting will be over. There's no description anywhere in the Scriptures of some huge, great, cataclysmic battle at the end of time. What then is Armageddon? The name Armageddon means Mount of Megiddo, which if you look on your map, you will see that on the map, the town and the valley next to it, Valley of Jezreel. The Bible speaks of Megiddo and its three heights in Joshua 17:11, Megiddo and its towns in Judges 1:27. The waters of Megiddo in Judges 5:19, the valley of Megiddo in 2 Chronicles and Zechariah. What does Megiddo mean? Even there's a clue. Because the name means place of troops. Place of troops. From its vantage point, up on the height, looking down into that valley, it was one of the most strategic places in the area. Huge strategic importance. Looking down at a trade route that went all the way from Egypt all the way up to the north. Vital position there in Megiddo. From the most ancient times to the time of Napoleon, even to the present day, Megiddo was one of the great battlefields of the world. One author states that the area surrounding the ancient site of Megiddo in the Jezreel Valley has seen more fighting and bloodshed over an extended period of time than virtually any other spot on earth. It was at Megiddo that Thutmose III fought in 1479 BC in what one scholar has called the first battle known in recorded history anywhere in the world. Although he also suggests that Pepi I may have had that honor. If you look at your chart, you'll see him listed in 2350 BC. It was at Megiddo that the Mongols lost their first major battle ever in their sweep across Asia. This is the plain where Barak and Deborah overthrew Sisera and his chariots in Judges 4. It was in this valley that Gideon's 300 men defeated the Midianites in Judges 7. Saul and Jonathan were killed here in the eastern edge of this valley in 1 Samuel 31. This is where Ahaziah died by the arrows of Jehu in 2 Kings 9. This is where Josiah perished in the battle with Pharaoh Necho in 2 Kings 23. That battle is particularly important because it's the fact that he delayed the Egyptians is what allowed the Babylon to in fact take over the world and later drag the Jews off into exile in 586 BC. All of that happened right here in this valley that we're looking at on that map. So why is Armageddon mentioned here in verse 16? Because God chose for this great scene the most famous battlefield on earth, still the most famous battlefield on earth, so that on that battlefield he could depict the complete and utter judgment and destruction of Rome. Napoleon once remarked that all of the armies of the world could make battle there. Dr. Eric Klein of the University of Cincinnati has written a book called The Battles, plural, of Armageddon. And he recounts in that book 34 battles that are fought in this city. Those are the 34 that are listed there on your handout. He goes through each of them. It's a fascinating book. Here's how he describes this area. For 4,000 years, this region has suffered almost constant warfare. Indeed, one may seriously ask if there has ever been a time when the rulers of the area, whether local or foreign, were not at war. The turbulent history of all Israel and Judah, Canaan and Palestine is reflected in microcosm, in this blood-soaked little valley. For virtually every major invader of Israel has had to fight a battle in the Jezreel Valley. Egyptians, Canaanites, Israelites, Midianites, Amalekites, Philistines, Greeks, Romans, Byzantines, Muslims, Crusaders, Mongols, Palestinians, French, Ottomans, British, Australians, Germans, Arabs, Israelites, they've all fought and they've all died there. Are those pictured as assembling in verse 16, doing so to fight a literal battle? No. It's no more literal than the battle in heaven that we studied earlier. Is it vivid language? Is it a vivid image? Absolutely, definitely. Armageddon was the perfect setting for this figurative battle between the Lamb and the dragon. It was the perfect stage for this great spiritual battle between the army of Satan and the army of God. This fight had been brewing since at least as early as Genesis 3. Where would we expect it to be pictured? Wouldn't we expect the greatest battle to be fought on the greatest battlefield? Well, that's where God is showing us. Homer Haley says, to look for a physical military battle between human armies to be fought in northern Palestine with carnal weapons at some future date is completely without scriptural support, and it's foreign to the spirit and to the purpose of Revelation. We're going to see a lot more about this battle when we get to chapter 19, verse 17. The seventh angel poured his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, "It is done." This seventh bowl poured into the air marks the culmination of the judgment of Rome. At this point, Rome's fate is sealed and its fall is inevitable. The verdicts of historians notwithstanding, the book of Revelation makes it clear that Rome fell because Rome persecuted Christians. Rome's fall was a divine judgment from God. The most powerful empire the earth had ever seen went up against the church and lost. Note that this bowl is poured into the air, thus completing the cycle of the elements that we've seen here. The earth, the water, the fire, the scorching sun, and the air. What does the air depict? Well, the fall of Rome was a great defeat for Satan. And it would affect Satan's entire sphere of operation. He had tried to kill Jesus when Jesus was just an infant through Rome under Herod, and he had failed. Satan had tried to kill the church in its infancy through Rome. Satan had failed. Satan was the power behind Rome, and Satan's complete defeat with regard to Rome will be described in chapter 20. Ephesians 2:2 tells us Satan is the prince of the air. That's why this bowl was poured into the air. With the seventh bowl, God declares, "It is done." His judgment is complete. The Greek word used here means it has become or it has occurred. Rome is finished. What happens next in verse 18? If that's a surprise to you, then you need to do some review. Verse 18 should be no surprise after what we've just seen in verse 17. Verse 18. And there were flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, a great earthquake such as had never been seen since men were on earth. So great was that earthquake. The great city was split into three parts and the city of the nations fell. And God remembered great Babylon to make her drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. And every island fled away, and no mountains were to be found, and great hailstones, heavy as 100 weight, dropped on men from heaven, till men cursed God for the plague of the hail. So fearful was that plague. As usual, a great judgment of God is accompanied by lightning and thunder and earthquakes. The purpose is to heighten the dramatic effect, and we've seen it many times before, even in this book. This earthquake was such as had never been seen since men were on earth. That is, this judgment is different from the previous judgments in this book of Rome. This judgment of the seventh bowl is God's final word against Rome. This judgment is total and complete. Since there had never been an empire like Rome, its collapse created an earthquake such as had never been seen. But doesn't that kind of description of an earthquake mean this bowl must correspond to the final judgment at the end of all time? No. Similar language is used elsewhere to describe other past judgments that were not the final judgment at the end of all time. Ezekiel 5, verses 8 and 9, describes the judgment against Judah at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. How does it describe it? I will do with you what I have never yet done, and the like of which I will never do again. And compare the description of God's judgment in A.D. 70 against Jerusalem, described in Matthew 24, verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been seen from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. Same kind of language we see right here. Same kind of language we saw back in Ezekiel chapter 5. All describing events that aren't the end of the world. God uses hyperbolic language like this when he gets to a judgment against the enemy of his people. We see it throughout Scripture. The islands flee. The mountains cannot be found. Huge 100-pound hailstones fall from heaven, reminding us of the seventh plague in Exodus chapter 9. And the great hailstones that fell in Joshua chapter 10. Again, such language often accompanies judgments in the Old Testament. We see it in Micah 1, 3 through 4. The mountains will melt. We see it in Nahum 1, 5. The mountains quake. The hills melt. Psalm 18, 7 through 13. The earth reeled and rocked. The mountains trembled and quaked. Clouds of hailstones, coals of fire. Ezekiel 26. The islands tremble. This is the language of judgment. That's what this is, the language of judgment. It's used throughout the Bible to describe judgments. Verse 19 says this city was divided into three parts. What does that mean? Many opinions on that. It may be borrowing language from the judgment of Jerusalem described in Ezekiel 5, verse 2, which also divides that city into three parts. I think it means here what it did mean there, and that is the total destruction of that city. It's just chopping it up. It's chopping it up into parts is what we see here. Verse 19 also tells us that Rome did not fall alone. The other cities of the nations fell with her. The pagan world is pictured as collapsing together with Rome. These cities had all drunk the wine of Rome's fornication, and now they were suffering the consequences. With the seventh bowl, God's judgments against Rome and against her allies is completed. The fall of the city will be described in more detail in chapter 17 and 18. The battle at Armageddon will be described in more detail in chapter 19. The defeat of Satan will be described in more detail in chapter 20. But the judgment is finished. Chapter 17. Chapters 17 and 18 are an obituary for the great city of Babylon, which we've seen can be none other than Rome. Babylon was said to have fallen in chapter 14. It was broken into three pieces in chapter 16. Chapters 17 and 18 provide the detail, the obituary for that fall. Recall that we've already discussed large portions of chapter 17 at length when we studied chapter 13. Because in chapter 17, an angel steps out of the image to explain to John what he's seen. And we looked at that when we studied chapter 13. And I'm not going to repeat all of that here, now that we finally arrived at chapter 17. But a main character in this chapter, chapter 17, is a great harlot named Babylon the Great. Chapter 17 and 18 will provide a number of descriptions of that great harlot. Listen to them as I read them and think, do these sound familiar? She's powerful. She's successful. She's arrogant. She's proud. She sits on seven hills. She rules the world in John's day. She's a terrible persecutor of God's people. She's the leading commercial power on earth. She's supported by a great military force. She's destroyed in part by her own military power and by inner strife. At the time this book was written, Rome was the only nation that fit those descriptions. The only one. Babylon is Rome, and Babylon is fallen. Verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who is seated upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers on earth have become drunk." In verse 1, we meet the great harlot, who, like Jezebel in the Old Testament, has been actively murdering God's people. But also, like Jezebel, she has been judged. And we're about to see the details of that judgment. Verse 1 tells us she is seated upon many waters. Later in verse 15, we'll find that these waters represent peoples and nations and tongues. She's seated upon them. She rules over them. Which city ruled the world when this book was written? Jerusalem? Hardly. Rome ruled the world when this book was written. Verse 1 tells us that this is Rome. Rome is being described here with Old Testament descriptions of ancient Babylon. For example, Jeremiah 51:13 addresses Babylon as "you who dwell by many waters." And that was literally true of ancient Babylon. We've already talked about it. Euphrates ran right through the middle of the city. Was that literally true of Rome? No, but it's the same figure. It's the same figure. It's to bring our minds back to that ancient enemy of God's people, Babylon, and to let us know that Rome would share its fate. Jeremiah 51:7 describes Babylon as a golden cup. We see that image here also later in verse 4. But did Rome literally rule the entire world? No. But Rome's dominion was so large that it was commonly described that way, even in the Bible. In Luke 2, verse 1, for example, we're told that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that who should be enrolled? All the world. All the world. That is how big Rome's dominion was. It was a common exaggeration of the time. And while we're talking about whether we should take these descriptions literally, what about the name of this city itself? Is this vision literally focused on the literal city of Babylon at this time? The Greek historian Siculus in the 1st century BC says that only a small part of that city was inhabited in his day. It was almost deserted. Strabo in AD 19 says it was in great part deserted. Another Greek traveler and geographer of the 2nd century said that nothing really remained of it except one temple and a part of a wall. Babylon was a ruin at this time. Was that the great persecutor John is writing about? Of course not. We know it was not. He was writing about Rome. And if Babylon, the name Babylon, is figuratively used to describe Rome, then under what theory do we say the 1,000 years is literal? How do we then start saying this is literal and that's figurative? We know figurative language is being used here because we know he could not possibly have been focused on the deserted city of literal Babylon at this time. He was talking about Rome. Verse 2 tells us the kings have committed fornication with this harlot. These kings had been her customers. Fornication in this context means these kings had joined in with Rome. They were on Rome's side. In the Old Testament, disobedient cities were often called harlots. Isaiah 23:17, we read that Tyre played the harlot with all the kings of the earth. Nahum 3:4, Nineveh betrayed nations with her harlotries. Isaiah 1:21, the prophet speaking of Jerusalem says how the faithful city has become a harlot. Ezekiel 16:15, you trusted in your beauty and you played the harlot. Those fornications, like those of Rome, involved treacherous and deceitful relationships with other nations, with false gods, aimed at harming the people of God. I think Barclay's right, though, and he notes there is great, great symbolism here. John 3:16 reminds us that God so loved the world. The world! God loved the world! And when we turn our backs on God, as Barclay reminds us, it's not so much a sin against law as it is a sin against love. The love of God. And that, I think, is pictured here as this city is pictured as a harlot. A second aspect may be that it's pointing to the sin of harlotry. in which a harlot sins not only against herself, but she causes other people to sin. She induces and tempts them to sin. And that also was certainly true of Rome. I think it's a very powerful image that Rome here is compared to a harlot. Verse 3. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and bedecked with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. On her forehead was written the name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. In verse 3, John is carried away into the wilderness. Over and over again in the Bible, we see men like Moses, and Elijah, John the Baptist, meeting God out in the wilderness. If our lives are too busy and too noisy to heed the Word of God and hear His Word, then maybe we need a little time out in the wilderness. And that may just mean turning off the TV and the phone for an hour. That's where we meet God, out in the wilderness. In chapter 12, the people of God were pictured as a woman out in the wilderness, being pursued by an angry dragon. The woman John sees here in chapter 17, also out in the wilderness. But we're going to see she is very, very different from that woman we saw in chapter 12. This woman sits upon a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, 7 heads, 10 horns. We discussed those at great lengths in our comments on chapter 13. And if you missed our comments on that chapter, you need to go find that on the website, thywordistruth.com. We went over those verses at great lengths. This beast appears to be the same beast from the sea that we saw in chapter 13. It represented Rome, the persecuting power. This harlot is dressed in purple and scarlet. She's arrayed with gold and jewels and pearls. Wealthy, royal, powerful in earthly terms. Beautiful in earthly terms. Rome thought of itself that way. Wealthy, powerful, beautiful. And you know what? There was a kingdom of that day that was wealthy and that was powerful and that was beautiful. But it was not Rome. It was not Rome. God tells us it was the church. It was the church of Christ. That was the wealthy, royal, powerful, beautiful kingdom of John's day. It was not Rome. Rome was this bloodthirsty harlot. That was what Rome was. It may have looked very different from this earth, but we must see things as God sees them. We must. The harlot offers a golden cup to the other nations. This description is likely an allusion back again to Jeremiah 51. Where Babylon was a golden cup. The mystery in verse 5, the mystery is just that Babylon means Rome. The harlot wears on her forehead the name Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of earth's abominations. She wears this title proudly as the high priest would have worn Jehovah on his forehead. Rome was proud of its abominations. Rome was proud of its fornications. It made no attempt to hide them. She displayed them proudly for all to see. Again, there is a historical connection with this description. A Roman prostitute in a public brothel wore a frontlet upon her forehead that gave her name for all to see, so they could remember her name. Barclay thinks these verses may have an even more precise historical allusion in mind. The Roman emperor, Messalina, was the wife of the Roman emperor Claudius, who preceded Nero. You know, sometimes you may see someone in power, a man in power and authority, and you kind of wonder, well, how did he get there? You know, what is it? How did this person get to where he is? And then you meet the wife, and then you understand. That may be the case here with Claudius. Listen to how Suetonius describes the emperor, the Roman emperor Claudius. Here's how an ancient historian describes him. His knees were weak and gave way under him, and his head shook. He stammered and his speech was confused. He slobbered and his nose ran when he was excited. Wonder how he got there. He had some powerful wives, plural, one of whom was Messalina. We could gather that from that description alone that she was powerful, that she wielded great influence. Well, guess what? She did. Up until the time Claudius had her killed. In any event, Juvenal, another historian of the time, tells us that at night, Messalina was so promiscuous that she would go down to the public brothels and sit there and work as a common prostitute. The wife of Claudius the emperor would do that at night. That's how promiscuous she was and Rome was. There may be a historical allusion back to that in this description of Rome. It sure would have rung a bell with some of them. And I think we should pause here to note something important about Rome. As bad as Rome is pictured in this book, it is pictured just as bad and possibly even worse by the pagans who lived there. Tacitus calls Rome the place into which all over the world all atrocious and shameful things flow and where they are most popular. Seneca called Rome a filthy sewer. These are not Christians writing this. These are Romans writing this. I like what Barclay said on this point. He says, "This was the civilization into which Christianity came, and it was out of this that men were converted to chastity." We may well speak, he writes, of the miracles of the cross. This harlot is vividly pictured as being drunk with the blood of the saints and of the martyrs. She is not just an ordinary persecutor. She is glutted with slaughter. She is reveling in the slaughter as a drunkard revels in his wine and in his drunkenness. Let's pick up in verse 6 where we left off. "When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, 'Why marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, of the beast with the seven heads and the ten horns that carries her.'" The mystery of these symbols was something that was previously not understood, but that has now been revealed and is being revealed right here as we see it. Throughout this explanation, we should reverse the rule that we've been using throughout our study of this book. That is, we should look at these explanations as literal unless there's some reason not to. Because why? Well, because the angel's explaining the apocalyptic language. He's telling us what it means. He's telling us what it stands for. I'll tell you, many commentators have big, big troubles with what this angel has to say. Why? Because this angel disagrees with them. They've got their own theories about the book of Revelation. And when they get to chapter 17, they're looking at this thing. Well, what does this angel know? He disagrees with what they... So what do? They figureize what this angel is saying. It's incredible to see. These commentators take the entire book or try to literally, and when they get to the angel where he's going to explain what it is, they say, oh no, that's figurative. They completely reverse things. It is an incredible thing to see. Verse 8, "The beast that you saw was and is not and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to behold the beast, because it was and is not and is to come." We've already discussed the bottomless pit. We've already discussed the book of life. We've already discussed this beast, which represents Rome as a civil persecuting power. Recall that the time when the beast was denotes the time of persecution under Nero. And the time when the beast is not is the lull in persecution between Nero and Domitian. At the time this book was written, which was during the reign of Vespasian. The beast is to come, that's the reign under Domitian. Nero redivivus, revived Nero, is what they thought. Nero was the first to actively persecute the church. The persecution had subsided considerably when this book was written. It was about to come back with a vengeance under Domitian. Juvenal said that Rome under Domitian was enslaved to a bald-headed Nero. Tertullian called Domitian a man of Nero's type of cruelty. A sub-Nero. Domitian renewed the persecutions against Christians that had been started by Nero. Verse 9. "This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to perdition." We saw this in chapter 13, and we spent an entire lesson on just those verses. That's how much time we've already spent on those verses. You'll recall the five kings who have fallen are Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero. All ruled and then died with Nero. That dynasty died with Nero. And then they were followed by three who ruled and died within just a few short months. Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. They're ignored here in Revelation. They aren't ignored back in Daniel, where they're described as plucked up horns, three plucked up horns. The king who is, that's Vespasian. That's when this book was written. The one who will come and reign only a short time is Titus, who ruled only 2 years. And this was written before that happened. You know, Titus was a young person. Everyone expected him to have a reign for 30, 40 years. That's what they all expected. No one ever expected his brother Domitian to be emperor. And yet Titus reigned for only 2 years. No one thought that. No one knew that. God knew it. He wrote it down right here before it happened, and he wrote it down back in Daniel, 600 years before it happened. God knew. The eighth king is Domitian, Titus's brother, who began where Nero left off with regard to persecuting the church. Verse 12. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. They are of one mind and give over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, the waters that you saw where the harlot is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the harlot. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind, giving over their royal power to the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city, which has dominion over the kings of the earth. Again, we've discussed these verses at length in our discussions of chapter 13. We've discussed several views about the 10 horns and the 10 kings. We're not going to repeat those here. But whatever they represent, verse 14 tells us something important about those 10 horns. The Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. Did Jesus' victory over those 10 horns make Jesus Lord of lords and King of kings? No. We're told that he conquered them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Jesus' victory over Rome and Rome's minions did not make Jesus king. Jesus was already king, and there's a lesson there for us. How often do we hear denominational preachers tell people they need to make Jesus Lord of their life? How often do we hear denominational songs tell people they need to crown Jesus King? There is not a shred of support in the Bible for such a notion. When Peter was asked, men and brethren, what shall we do in Acts 2:37, did he tell them they need to make Jesus Lord of their life? No, in fact, that would have made no sense to them. Why? Because they had just been told in verse 36 that God hath made that same Jesus both Lord and Christ. Jesus was already Lord. They were told to obey him because he was Lord, not to make him Lord. Jesus is Lord of lords. That means he's everybody's Lord. Jesus is King of kings. That means he's everybody's king. The next time you see the word king or lord in a song, pause and consider what it is we're being asked to sing. Jesus is King of kings and Lord of lords. Nowhere in Revelation does Jesus begin to rule over something new that he did not previously rule over. He has all authority when this book begins. He has all authority when this book ends. He reigns over the entire universe when this book begins. He reigns over the entire universe when this book ends. He is King of kings and Lord of lords when this book begins. He is King of kings and Lord of lords when this book ends. Do we see a new expression of that reign in this book? Yes. But do we see in this book Christ reigning over something that he did not previously reign over? No. This book is happening because he is King of kings and Lord of lords. Many denominational interpretations of this book belittle the church and belittle the work of Christ. And we're going to be talking more about that as we move on into these final chapters and into the false doctrine of premillennialism. And we'll start with some remaining comments on these verses next week. Thank you very much for your attention.